認 OK。
Hello, Internet. Welcome back to the Dice Section. I'm Dave Kirby, and I'm joined by Michael Harrison.
Hello, everybody.
And I'm also joined by Jeff Baracknik.
We have tried this so many times.
Only three.
But I'm laughing because I totally expected him to just to punt it to Jeff first this time.
We gotta
screwed it up every off. Other one.
We got to kick the dust off every now and then.
It has been a while, so.
Michael, tell us about your recent move.
Do I have to?
You don't have to.
I don't want to relive it. It's been really stressful. So we're finally at the point in our lives where we can kind of like afford to hire people to take care of everything for us, which makes me sound like a giant baby. But you know, we hired a moving crew, and I was like working at home when they came in and started moving all of our stuff, putting it into boxes, etc. And I have to say that I think I miss the physical stress of lifting boxes and putting them into a truck and moving them to a new house. I prefer that much more to the mental stress of having a bunch
dealing
of
dealing with the serving class.
No. No. Those guys were amazing and they're awesome, but I think there's something in my like lizard brain that cannot deal with people going through my stuff.
I promise you, movers are not trying to look at the skid marks in your underwear, Mike.
That's not even it. It's not like my personal stuff. It's just this low level stress throughout the entire day of like, I should be helping them. Like, that's my stuff. I should be doing that, but they're doing it. And what the hell's wrong with me?
Michael and I share this same problem where, like, I'm at a restaurant and someone's job to wait on me. It's a job I do for a living. And yet I feel just unreasonably guilty that someone else has reached around me in the middle of my sentence to another person to refill my glass of water. I'm like, oh, that's so petty that I would expect someone to refill my water, even though I'm paying for this service. And they came to work knowing they would do it. It's irrational completely.
I think it comes. I think it comes from actually doing I've done plenty of service jobs, and I am a socially awkward person who has plenty of service experience, and was super socially awkward while doing the service job, and I'm like, if these people were anything like I was in my service job, then they hate me right now, or they think I'm really weird.
Oh man, Jeff, you've had service jobs before, right? Where were you mentally?
Checked out.
But you didn't take it personally, right?
I was a bartender. Like, I was dealing with a bunch of drunks. Like, I was a bartender at a college bar. That was like specifically a party college bar. So I was just dealing with human beings that only wanted me to turn them into people who are even less paying less attention to me than they were a moment ago.
Yeah, I mean, I am a bartender now, and like at least 9 out of 10 people, when I am doing like petty services for them, like picking up a glass of water and putting it back down with more water in it, you know, I don't take it personally that they don't necessarily acknowledge every single time I touch their glass or not. It's that one person who very clearly views me as like a cog in a physical machine rather than a human being who is doing something for them. You know, that's the person that you get irritated by. So like, having all of us done that, I think, Michael, you and I, it's so unreasonable for us to be worried about it, because we're always saying, please, thank you, don't worry about that, like to an insane degree. They're not worried about us, and yet we're the ones who are most worried about it.
We're doing it to the point where we're probably irritating them on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Well,
or maybe not. That's just me being a freak.
Do you think we're irritating the people that came here to hear us talk about games?
No, but
we're getting close.
We're getting close. I just want to mention before we start talking about role player, One, I've played a ton of Civilization VI since we last recorded. Yeah. I kept saying I was going to get back to it, and it's, you know, it's one of the most board gamey computer games out there, right? The 4X genre in general is very board gamey, and I don't think I gave Civ 6 enough credit at first, but then also they've done some like very small incremental updates over the last 6 months since it came out. It's starting to become something I could recommend to someone who liked Civ 4 or Civ 5. I don't know. Jeff, you haven't played Civ 6 yet, right?
I have not. My Etch-a-Sketch will not run it.
Well, if they put out like a full-fledged expansion at some point, you know, it's something I really want to return to. Again, I cranked in like maybe 50 additional hours on top of the 20 that I played right when it came out. I thought maybe I'm just done with Civ. Maybe I played too much of it, but it's pretty good. I think it's worth checking out. I don't know. This is not really the purview of this show, but
hey, you know, video games that are similar to board games, that's fine.
We've also played a lot of a video board game, right? We've gotten back into online asynchronous Lords of Waterdeep.
Yeah, and I'm really worried because any day now, Apple is gonna like, you know, pop out that new update, that what iOS 9 or 10 or 11, I don't know what number it is, but that game's gonna stop working, and I don't know what I'm gonna
Thank
do.
Thank God, I am so far behind in our game. Reset.
I finally got the. What's the name of the lord that uses the corruption mechanic in the expansion? Scoundrels
the Xanathar?
Yeah, I'm the Xanathar, which makes you think, oh, it's so powerful, I can just take all the corruption that I want. And then at the end of the game, I think I'm going to lose to you by 50 or 60 points the end of this game that you and I and Natanya are playing. Michael, it's just real embarrassing.
Oh, you haven't seen it's done.
Oh, it's done? I haven't loaded it up. Okay, how much did I lose by?
Something close to that.
Okay, cool. No spoilers. Don't actually tell me.
I came pretty close to the hundo lap, and
nice.
I screwed it up at the very end by not cashing in a quest. Like I had it all ready, and then I accidentally hit the advance button, and Natanya just heard me like shriek from the bathroom. I was like,
and she knows because she and I played a head-to-head game last week or a couple weeks ago where she absolutely walloped me and would have done so by like 15 or 20 more points if she hadn't done the exact same thing on her last turn.
It's the worst. That game has a pretty good interface, especially considering I'm playing it on my phone.
Yeah,
but there's still some easy ways to fat finger your way through it.
Well, sound off, both of you guys. When you see the little green arrow to end turn pop up, aren't you just you want to push it right away, even if the next thing you need to do is complete a quest?
No, I never push it. Like the one of the reasons, like I don't know if you guys have noticed that like turns tend to take a while on my turn. It's because I do my turn. And then I don't, like, you know, I finish the quest and then I'm like, oh, thank God. And then I, like, you know, throw the iPad back onto the bed and, like, walk away. Only to then come back, you know, 6 hours later to see the exact same series of actions being done by former players, realizing that the game had not accepted my move.
Oh, yeah. It replays everybody's turn if you
so slowly
don't, like, kind of lock in your move. Yeah. My biggest problem is that I spend so much time trying to figure out the optimal move.
Yeah,
I'm completely unhindered by any sort of social contract against analysis paralysis that I'll just sit there for like 10 minutes.
And it's as I've got 45 days and I'm going to take all 45 days.
Yeah. So by the time I see that green button, I'm like, oh God, thank God I can stop doing this.
So you do want to push it too quickly sometimes then, at least is what you're saying.
And that's what happened last night.
Well, I think we can return to Lords later on, maybe like in this same episode, because there's some, you know, multiplayer solitaire concepts to discuss. Sort of related to the game we're talking about, which is Role Player. That was a game kickstarted very early last year, early 2016, and released late 2016, designed by Keith Mateka of Thunderworks Games. There's art by John Ariosa and Luis Francisco, who is Brazilian. I made sure to look that up. Aren't you guys proud of me?
Nice.
Wow, research.
So, Role Player is a 1-4 player game. There is like a compelling solo mode. You're sort of trying to create the best role-playing game character. And I think you guys probably agree with me that a huge draw for this game is some familiarity with the classic Dungeons & Dragons character creation, where you take 3 6-sided dice and you roll them to generate 6 different attributes, like strength, dexterity, constitution, and so on.
And most importantly, you don't have to go through the tedium of playing a role-playing game. You just get the joy of building a character.
Which we're all addicted to, right? We all like generate characters like idiots.
I wonder how much you could possibly love this game if there isn't at least a little part of you that, you know, as a 12-year-old kid, just wanted to sit down and roll a bajillion different characters in AD&D 2nd Edition just to see what you could do with the system.
Yeah.
The ratio of characters created in my lifetime to hours or maybe even minutes playing role-playing games is pretty rough.
So there's a lot of pretty simple mechanics in this game that all are really interconnected. So try to build a picture in your head of what your character sheet looks like in front of you when you're playing here. You start with a pretty classy cardboard character sheet, and it's got a cutout 3x6 grid where you're going to place your dice as the game progresses. Like 3 wide for 3d6s, and then 6 tall for the 6 attributes. And your cardboard sheet has a race on it: human, elf, orc, dragonkin. The race will modify some of your attributes in the very final calculations of the game. And then you get randomly, or maybe by choice, depending on what the player's like, a character class, like warrior, cleric, monk, or bard, or whatever. And that character class has some attribute goals associated with it, like you need to have intelligence of 14 or higher at the end of the game. Or you need to have a strength of 16 or 17.
But not 18.
Or a dexterity of exactly 17. Or a strength of exactly 18 or 18 or up. Whatever. When you get to the end of the game, you're going to score points based on how many of those attribute goals you completed. And then based on your class, certain attribute goals will be more valuable. Like the monk, you really want to have a strength of 18 or above for the monk. But, you know, getting an intelligence of 14 and up, that's not as important. Then each of the character classes has like a special class ability, which we can go over much later once you understand the rest of the mechanics, dear listener. And then they also correspond to 1 of 6 different dice colors, and grabbing those dice gives you just flat points. If you're a wizard, a blue die is worth 1 point at the end of the game. So then the next random thing or chosen thing you get is a backstory card. You might be resilient. You might be a chosen one. You might be a savant. And that's just a little guide of your 3x6 grid. 1 die spot in each of the 6 rows corresponds to a particular die color. So your strength, your 3rd strength die, you're going to get some points if that's blue. And then later on, your 1st intelligence die. If your 1st intelligence die is white, you're going to get some points for that. So here's another goal to try to achieve, and you score at the end of the game. Then you get an alignment card. You might be a scoundrel or a guardian or a free spirit. This gives you a little 3x3 grid that's in the classic good, neutral, evil, lawful, neutral, chaotic, like D&D style. And at the end of the game, you want your alignment to be whatever the alignment card suggests. Like a guardian, I think, is a lawful, neutral, or lawful good, right? So you want to be in that corner or that top middle spot, whichever it is. Now, doing some things in the game are going to shift your alignment a space in one direction on the grid if it's possible to move in that direction. And then doing some other things in the game are only possible if you can move your alignment a space in a specific direction. Like, it's not up against an edge. So now you've got all these things, and you're looking at maybe a halfling, lunatic, riftwalker, paladin. Which sounds cool, and then there's also a whole bunch of goals that you can sort of plan for. So deep breath. Do you have this picture in your head?
I've such played a this beautiful game picture. A dozen times and still don't.
I mean, just before you even take any turns, right? Like, you're looking at a bunch of different things that you can try to pursue, right? So for a player like Michael, this is like both a vast and exciting possibility space and a terrifyingly vast and exciting possibility space.
Yeah, because if you don't do everything, then you're a failure, right?
No,
I mean, your mommy and your daddy will not like you. and there's a chance that you'll die homeless and alone.
So it can feel that way, kind of, right? You know, this is something we'll discuss a little later on, what it feels like to play the game, for sure. But how do turns work? It's pretty simple. It's just that you have a lot of different goals you can pursue. What you actually do isn't all that complicated. You've got a first player for each turn, and that player is going to draw some of the dice out of the dice bag, just at random, without looking, and then roll them. If there's three players in the game, you draw four dice, you roll them, you're looking at dice with certain face values, 1 to 6, right? And then certain colors. There's 6 class colors, and then there's gold. You just take the dice, arrange them low to high by face value, and then that first player gets the first pick of the dice. So, do you take go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, I was going to say, it is like a random selection of dice. You're reaching your hand into a black bag and pulling out 3 or 4 or 5 of these 72 dice that are in the bag.
It's like Scrabble style, yeah.
Right.
And what, there's 7 different colors, I think you said?
Yeah, 6 class colors and then gold. So you're looking at some options here. And what do you pick? Do you pick a particular face value because you want to focus on an attribute goal? Like, if you have a strength score of 18, then you're going to need to pick a lot of 6s to get there. Or you can prioritize a particular color die because you want to focus on your backstory, and you need that blue die right there, right now, because you're about to place your strength die that needs to be blue. And then, hey, maybe you're a wizard and you need a blue die anyway because it's worth extra points. Or you can grab a gold die, which really does nothing special for you except give you gold. You take that die, and then the next thing you do is place it into one of those open die slots. If you put it into any particular slot, it's associated with an attribute action. Like, if you place a strength die, you can flip any die that's already on your character sheet, or the one you just placed, to the opposite side face value. Like, a 1 would become a 6, or a 2 would become a 5. Or if you put it into dexterity, you can swap 2 dice on your sheet. So, very simple, but there's a lot of choices you can make in this die selection round.
Then, there are a lot of choices.
Yeah, a lot. It sounds really easy, right? That wasn't that hard to explain, but when you're looking at everything you can be pursuing, it's kind of complicated to make that choice. And it gets more complicated because after you all choose dice, then you go to the market, and whoever chose the lowest die, lowest face value, now shops first. And there's randomly selected market cards. There might be armor, there might be weapons, there might be character traits or character skills. Armor cards, they're just going to give you points. You're collecting armor cards from sets, and the more you get out of a set, the better the returns are, and each class matches a certain set. That's simple. There's weapon cards that give you, like, unique bonuses, either for scoring at the end of the game or, like, extra stuff you can do during the game based on certain, you know, conditions. There are trait cards. They score endgame points based on specific codes. Like, I think Clumsy is a card that gives you a couple points if your dexterity or your charisma score end up being 8 or lower. So rather than pursuing that attribute goal, maybe you buy this trait card and try to get a very low wisdom. And then some of those can be pretty difficult, like a card that gives you points for every row of your attributes that is the same face value or color. And then finally, when you buy the trait card, it's going to move you on your alignment track. So, like, honest, I think, is one that moves you toward lawful or good or whatever. Some move you in a certain direction. Then there's skill cards that you can also buy that you can use, like, once a turn, more or less. And they allow you to do specific actions that you couldn't do otherwise. Like, the knowledge skill will let you increase or decrease the face value of one of your dice on the character sheet. But you can only use the skill cards if you can move your alignment in the specific direction that it demands. So, yeah, knowledge...
It's an interesting mechanic because it's like, you know, I think pickpocket is one of them, right? And it like moves you down toward evil, but you can only do it a certain number of times before you've like maxed out your evilness.
Right.
And then you can't steal again until you've done a good thing.
Exactly, yeah.
Just like real life.
Just like real life. You just feel so bad that you have to do something honest before you can go, like, be awful again. You've maxed out your capacity. So then the last thing you could do is just discard something out of the options in the market and get some gold, which you might do just because you can't afford anything, or you might do because you want to deny someone else the option to buy it, and you know you're shopping ahead of them. So at the end of the game, you just look at your completed character sheet and how many of your attribute goals did you get? Is your strength high enough? How many dice of your class color did you get? Like, I have 5 blue dice and I'm a wizard. How many of the backstory goals did you complete? Like, did I get the red and the white and the blue dice in the right spot? Where's my alignment? How many pieces of armor did I get? How many successful trait cards did I finish up with? You add all these together, and then you've got what the game calls your reputation, and then whoever's got the highest score wins. So, not that complicated at any given step, but if you're thinking about all the possible like ramifications of every one thing you do being an opportunity cost or enabling something else to happen, or like which goal is more important, you know, it's there's a lot to think about from place to place. So, deep breath. First off, do we like this game?
Yes, I do.
Yes. Okay. See you next week. No. Okay, so Michael, just tell me first of all, what does it feel like to play this game at any given point? Because you and I have differing levels, I think, of analysis paralysis. Like at the very beginning of the game in particular, when you've just got like 6 or 7 dice to apply before the game, you know, starts proper, it can feel a little overwhelming, right? What do I do with these 6 dice before we take our first turn?
Yeah, I was joking earlier, but I legitimately feel like every time I start this game that I don't know what my strategy is going to be, and it's hard for me to look at kind of my class, race, alignment, backstory, and get a cohesive tack for what I'm going to try to do. And so I mentioned this, you know, that every time I sit down and play the game, I feel like I'm in like an alien spaceship, and there's all of these like multicolored levers that I'm looking at, and I'm not really sure what happens. I know if I pull one of them, something's, you know, maybe another one's gonna react to it, and there's all of these interactions, and it's a little overwhelming when I first start out. And what I've noticed the more that I've played is that I've gotten, and we played this game, what, like 6 or 7 times?
7 or 8, I feel like, between all of us, but yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like the beginning of the game is always the same. I feel overwhelmed and don't know what I'm going to do. And then in the middle, there's this like amazing sweet spot where I'm like, yeah, this is it. I know what's happening. I know my strategy, and I know I need to do this, and I need to do this, and I am going to win so badly. This is going to be great. And then the last like 3 dice coming onto the sheet, I'm back to the beginning. I'm just like, I'm garbage at this. What's happening? What happened to my strategy? I was wrong. I've been wrong this whole time. So
those last 3 dice come down. I don't think there's so much of a room for analysis paralysis as there is just for regret.
Right.
I needed any one of these dice to either be a 1 or a green die, and they're it's 3 4s and it's black and blue.
So, yeah, like the turn-to-turn feel of making the decisions but constrained by what your options are, I think that's what like makes the game so replayable for me. The interactions between all the mechanics, like those are always going to be pretty compelling. But then there's the fact that if you just don't see a white 6, you have to start making the best of a bad situation, right? Or if Michael goes before me and that white 6 comes up, but he's playing a cleric, so he's like, white 6, hell yeah, I'm definitely going to take that. Well then, damn, I don't get to do it. Now I have to make, you know, a choice based on what's limited and there for me.
Yeah, I feel like I'm constantly overreaching too with the game. I'm always trying to do too much, and you know, one of the things this game teaches you how to do is to choose failure, right? Like
the dump stat is a real thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's difficult because I've mentioned this before that part of, especially with spatial games like this, where you're arranging things, like it my brain feels better when I'm getting everything just so. And you can't get everything just so in this. Like you're gonna have some areas where you don't make all of your goals. Except there was the one game that I played where I just so happened to have the right combination of class and skills and traits and everything to where I did. I literally shot the moon and I got everything that I wanted.
And you walloped us score-wise, yeah.
Yeah.
And even so, I realized like how unlikely that was.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
And you
it's
say I
rolling
walloped you,
dice.
but I think I beat you by like only 4 points.
And Dave beat me by like 4 points as well. And I scored exactly the same as I did in the game before where I beat the both of you.
Right, yeah. The range of scoring is it feels kind of Euro in the end, right? Like your 29 is like maybe on the lower end of scoring just because by the end of the game you're likely to score, 24 to 28 points even if you're barely trying, and then like 36 to 40 does it, like just on an objective looking at these points numbers that doesn't sound that much higher, but it's like that's a game that went incredibly well for you just because there's so many different directions to like funnel your effort toward that it's unlikely you're really going to get everything right. That game where you score 36 to 40, really everything came up like totally aces for you. It was all coming up, Michael. That game when you were the rogue with all the right skills and then all the dice that showed up and let you do exactly what you wanted, every time it was your turn to choose.
It felt good, and it'll never happen again.
What does it feel like for you, Jeff? I mean, like all three of us have won or lost or come in second or third or whatever. What does it feel like to play this game?
So I really enjoy it just because, so like you were saying, so there's six different attribute scores, and there's three dice base, so you've got 18 different cubes that you're manipulating, and you're trying to plan ahead for, and I just really love the forecasting. I it doesn't always pan out for me, but I still think that it's a really delightful little game to play. It doesn't seem to have I wouldn't say that I truly love this game. This is not like a game that I'm going to put on my top 10 ever played list, but because it's like we were like Michael was saying, or maybe like I was saying when I was responding to him, it does feel like you start off and you've got no idea what you're doing. There's this brief joyous moment in the middle where you feel like suddenly you have this plan and the plan is taking shape, and then it just comes down to at the very end, it's rolling dice, and any time that you're rolling dice, you're just sort of at the whims of fate.
I
That
think.
doesn't.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say that doesn't feel great just because there is that last turn moment where it's just like, well, if the right color of dice comes out of that bag and there's at least two of them, then I'm going to win this, and if the dice are all rolled really low, then I'm just sunk because I need to get at least a four in one thing.
I think what I enjoy most about it is it's funny that I had been playing a lot of Civilization VI because I remember. Sid Meier was interviewed by Soren Johnson, another Civilization game designer, on a podcast called Designer Notes. I think that was a couple years ago or last year. And the question was, why is Civilization such a compelling game that people can't stop playing in any given session? And Sid Meier says, I think it's because so much of the game exists in the near, medium, and long-term future. And I think that's what's true for me about this game. Like you just said, Jeff, a lot of it is, well, if I make this move now, and then I plan to use a dexterity action to increase the value of this move I'm taking now 3 turns from now, because I'm going to swap this die that I got now with a die I'm going to place in this other spot, that's like 3 turns ahead already exciting for me. Or maybe it's 10 turns ahead, because what I'm waiting for is a red six. And if that ever comes up, it's exciting. If it doesn't, it's less exciting. But in my head, the fact that that's already something like cool that is likely or somewhat probable of happening, that keeps me excited about it for the whole game.
Yeah, definitely.
Does it keep you excited for the whole game, or does it keep you excited for most of the game? And then the end is somewhat anticlimactic as suddenly you realize that your options shrink rapidly.
I mean, yeah, maybe a little bit, like that last turn or two. You know what you really want to be able to do, and if it doesn't come up, then you can't do it. I think for each player, that's going to be a different level of drop off, right?
I kind of feel like there are two things that kind of mitigate the issue that you're talking about, Jeff. One of them is that you have these attribute abilities that do kind of allow you to, even if you have a bum roll, to kind of modify it and move things around and kind of prod it in the right direction. And then the second thing is that if you were getting down to the last three rounds of the game, and you really are like depending on specific numbers coming up or specific colors for your strategy, then like you done goofed, because that's not this game. Like you have to leave it open enough, I think, to allow yourself to kind of squeeze out a few extra points at the very end. And the other thing about that is that you have the marketplace is stacked so that the cards that are coming up at the very end of the game are kind of a different deck than the cards coming up in the beginning. And they're very much focused on kind of giving you the opportunity to fix your mistakes and to just give yourself like raw points if that's necessary, which I find is kind of a good balancing act.
That is a good point. Yeah. Like the market cards that you can buy at the very end, they tend to be things you would buy because you know you've already fulfilled a less likely goal, like the one that says for every row of attributes where all three dice are the same face value, like if they're all fours, you get some points. That's something that's very unlikely for you to be able to plan your whole game strategy around, but maybe at the end of the game you just happen to have a row that's all fours and a row that's all fives, and then okay, hey, I'm gonna buy that now, right? The other thing I think is important to remember is that what you're saying about the attribute actions letting you sort of hedge, that's another like long-term resource that you're sort of balancing through the entire game, right? That red die that I could put in my last strength spot to complete my backstory that I draw on turn two or three. Maybe I don't put it there because I need that strength action at the very end of the game, you know, as a hedge for when I need a six, but a one comes up. Now I can use that strength action to swap something to a six.
Yeah, I said that, you know, that you've screwed up if you get to the last couple of rounds and you have a very like brittle and sort of one note strategy that has to depend on specific results.
But I didn't screw up. Like,
what I'm saying is like I've done that every single time. Like that's how every single one of my games has ended. So I'm not practicing what I'm preaching, I guess.
No, so like, see, one of the issues that I have, though, is that I didn't screw up. I need a four or a five in a dexterity slot because I need to switch this one and a six between these two other attributes. And no fours or fives come up, and then the end of the game starts getting close, and I have to complete my dexterity to get a 16 or a 17, and I need to switch these two dice, and then it just doesn't come up. It's not available. And there's a six and there's a three, but I can't use those there because then I lose both things that I'm going for.
But the beauty of this game is that, you know, if you're saying that that's a myopic way to look at the game is too strong, right? Maybe you're playing a rogue and completing the correct dexterity attribute goal is worth like 4 points, a really significant score. Okay, that's something that, yes, you should be focusing on. But if you don't, then a whole lot of other possibilities open up to you, right? Maybe instead of taking the die with a certain face value or color, you just take a gold die more often, and then you have more gold to spend in the market, and then you can spend, you know, like use those market cards to accomplish other goals that end up giving you points. Or maybe you just ignore the face value in favor of the right color die. You're just going to take the black die every single time it comes up because you're a rogue, and then every time you see something that lets you complete your backstory, you get those points because you've been focusing on that. Like, when one thing doesn't work, it doesn't necessarily mean that another one will work, but there's a lot of different ways to feel like you're progressing toward endgame points. Not just feel like, there are a lot of ways to be doing that. It's hard to juggle it all in your head, and I agree with you that the last couple turns, maybe you are whittled down to a few things that either are or are not going to happen to score you those last few points. But I don't consider that such a huge knock against the game, because so frequently I look at the options for any particular die choice and I feel like, okay, this one goes this direction, but that one goes that direction and that one goes that direction.
So somewhat related to that, if I can get back to the market for just a moment, the one of the strongest things I feel about this game, and I definitely feel it after we played the game where we did not use the market mechanic of having the early market cards and the late market cards. So there's a certain set.
We shuffled them all together.
Yeah, there's a bunch of hacks to this game that I suggest trying out, but yeah, that one is one we did play.
So in doing so, we took out the in general, no, you're going to see all of the early market cards. You may not have a chance to buy them because someone else might that you're playing with might go and buy it from you first, or just discard it from the market before you have a chance to. But you're going to see all the early market cards, and you may or may not see some of the late market cards. And you're going to see all the early market cards early. And one thing I really think is just so strong is how they balanced all the costs of these things. And a lot of these early market cards do give you guidance for other things that you can do in the game in order to score points, as opposed to the late market cards where you're just picking up sort of random chance things that have already happened for your character.
You mean, like, for example, something that only costs a couple gold might be worth 3 or 4 points at the end of the game, but it will steer you in a very specific play style. Whereas something at the end of the game might cost 6 or 8 gold and score you the same number of points at the end, but it's not something that, like, drives your decisions through the rest of the game. That's what you mean?
Right, exactly. And I do feel that it's really helpful. Like you were saying, if you're trying to do some sort of alternate strategy where you're not paying attention to what I feel is, like, the main goal of the game is to get all of your attributes into the correct slots. I feel that that's the base thing that you tell someone who's playing this game for the first time, who has got no idea about maybe role-playing character creation. Just try to get these 3 dice to add up to these numbers, and that's a good way for you to at least score 20 points in this game.
Agree there, definitely, because I think Mateika designed it that way too, right? Like, it's the most points. You could get 12 points from your attributes, so it's an easy first priority to pursue.
Right. But if you toss that out and you want to do these fun things where you're trying to get four colored dice in a column to all be the same colors, and all 3 in this row to be the same color, you can score an awful lot of points if you do that. But those cards only come up at the very beginning of the game, so, and they come up every single game, so you really do actually have that opportunity. If you manage to buy that card, then you can run away with the game. And if you see someone else preparing themselves to do that, why, then you can take that card away from them and make them very sad.
Yeah, sorry, definitely. No, that was actually, so that's something we need to discuss, right? How much are you interacting with other players in this game, and how much is it just a multiplayer solitaire? I think it depends on the temperament of the players at the table, right? So we were playing a 3-player game where I happened to have a couple stats that looked like, okay, these are going to be stats I don't care about, right? I'm not going to pursue wisdom or charisma. I've just decided I'm going to focus on the other attributes because to my character class, they're just not worth as much. And then we see a couple cards come up in the market, like, you get a ton of points for having low scores. And obviously those light up to me like Shangri-La, because, hey, this could turn what I'm already doing into something way more valuable. And then on 2 consecutive turns, Jeff, you bought one or discarded it. I can't quite recall. And then Michael bought another one or discarded it just to deny them from me. Like, it wasn't like you were sacrificing your total option, you know, like you weren't just wasting a whole action to get me out and then, like, letting Michael run ahead or vice versa, because you both devoted one action to knocking me down. And then I came in last in that game.
Well, I don't know about Michael. I think that Michael actually scored his, but I totally took one of those cards, not really with the intention of scoring any points off of it myself. Like, that was definitely me just trying to stop you from running away with the game. Like, yeah. It was a little bit of a feel bad moment because I thought that I was tossing the game in Michael's favor.
But then he did the same thing the next turn because he was also still worried about me being able to shoot the moon with a different card, right?
Yeah, I mean, if it's the difference between, like, giving you 4 points for a set of armor or something like that and me getting 0 points for it, you know, it just seems like it it's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, sometimes there's really easy calculations there. But other than like discarding or buying someone else's card ahead of them in the market phase, or taking a die that might be worth a point to them or help them complete another attribute, like unless you are looking directly at someone else's goals and options, there's nothing in this game that's like mechanically interactive, right? You're basically just using an action to deny them an action in kind of a worker placement concept. You know, it might feel familiar, like in a Lords of Waterdeep turn where Michael really needs to go to the Grinning Lion Tavern or whatever it's called to get some rogues. I'm just going to deny him that so he can't complete this quest. There's no gotcha cards where it's like, you lose 2 gold because I played this card on you. There's none of that, which is why this makes a pretty good solo game. You just remove the other players, and the one-player version is still pretty compelling. You've got all the same mechanics, interactions, and priority choices to make. Do you guys think it should be more or less interactive, or is it good where it is? Michael?
I think it's got a great balance right now, but I love the fact that, so there's an expansion that is coming out for this game, and I like the fact that the expansion could potentially have some stuff that increases the interactivity between the players. Because I think it's a good option. I think that as it stands right now, there's definitely a bit of a multiplayer solitaire issue with the game. But it works. It's still satisfying, and I still have a lot of fun playing it. And I think there's just enough interaction to where, you know, it's different than when you play it solo, when you're playing it with other people. But I'm looking forward to seeing what the expansion could add.
Playing your own game requires an awful lot of mental headspace as is. Trying to worry too much about other players, I think, is something that is just going to throw you really deep into AP. And
that will never happen with me. I don't know.
Yes, I know. So I really like sort of the limited interactions. Really, the only choice of interaction that you have with other players is taking something away from them by taking it for yourself. That's something in every worker play, and that definitely is a worker placement mechanic. You know, that's a little bit disguised here, but it's a great little thing to make this not completely multiplayer solitaire. But I don't know how much interaction with other players I really want to be getting into in a game where I'm worrying about where 18 different dice land up of 7 different colors, and also worrying about the little alignment tracker, and worrying about trying to collect my chain armor set because I'm an orc barbarian.
Well, you're a misanthrope, so you don't like interaction in general.
Wouldn't he love it if there were gacha mechanics then? Maybe? I don't know. I think I agree with you, Jeff. I think there is the right amount of interaction in this game because, like, that first playthrough is so overwhelming if you're really trying to grok it all at once. The first time I played it with 4 people, none of us spent even a second thinking about what we could do to make it harder for any other player at the table. We were all just playing our own game and, like, you know, drinking a beer and shooting the breeze. And it was awesome, right? I feel like 6 plays in now, every time I feel like I'm able to devote like a little higher percentage of my thought process to how valuable is this to me and how damaging is it to my opponents if I take this choice. And that feels good.
Oh, definitely being able to interact with your opponents is sort of a level up moment. Don't you have a mute?
You didn't even have to say anything. You know, it probably wasn't going to get picked up. I bet Zencaster is doing all the work of editing out that cough, lean away from the mic thing that I just did. And now we're just talking about it. Thanks, Jeff.
Are you feeling okay, Dave?
No, I'm not. And now I'm feeling bad emotionally, too.
Who's a misanthrope?
You made me feel bad.
Yeah, you're right. And now I feel good. So anyways, so gacha mechanics, like being able to insert your own gacha mechanic in terms of stealing something away from someone or shaming them for coughing into a microphone. Really, it does feel good, and that's why I don't think that there needs to be explicit gacha mechanics. You know, a change this dice on the other guy's table to a one, or you know, remove all black dice from target player's board and make them draw new dice for it.
Yeah, there's a fine line for sure. I could see that stuff being pretty annoying, but
because well, you feel a lot smarter when you're doing something that isn't explicitly you know, damaging another player, but it just has that accidental fun bonus of doing it.
Well, the intentional bonus, right? It's like, it's great that I'm doing this because it helps me and hurts them both.
Yes.
I think the best multiplayer solitaire games, the fewer players you have in a game, the more they start to approach like the zero-sum kind of mechanics, because then they become really great head-to-head games. Maybe not the best. Maybe the ones I like the most, right? Like, this one is not necessarily that, right? It stops at a certain point. Maybe not even one of the ones I like the most, now that I think about it.
Well, wait, what do you mean? Because I feel like this is a fantastic head-to-head game.
I mean, like, as you... Zero-sum is the wrong term. I mean, it becomes easier to tell whether your action is beneficial to yourself, damaging to your opponent, or both.
Yeah.
Right? Like, playing this head-to-head, it becomes pretty easy to keep track of what's on my sheet and what's on Michael's sheet. And then every time I make a choice, I can take both of those into account, right? As a 3-player game, that's a little harder. As a 4-player game, it's almost impossible, at least in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we played a good portion of this game online with Tabletopia, and it's really nice to be able to just like set the views so that, you know, I can tap like my 5 key, and I'm hovering over Dave's board, and I'm seeing exactly what he's doing. Whereas if we're playing around a table and I'm doing that, you know, that's a little frowned upon.
It's a little harder for sure. Yeah. What do you think then, as far as like what groups are going to want to play this game? Because there's a certain level of, when it is your turn to think, you are zoned off from the rest of the world, right? Like, if this is your conversation game, but you also, like, care about the results of your competitive, you know, 4-player after-dinner game, I don't think this one works, right? It's not really applicable for that.
So, no, Chuck and I played this game while watching a baseball game, and it is perfect for that, where so that you can sort of dip into and out of this game. I feel like when it's your turn, you can spend a little time actually focusing on what's going on, and when it's the other person's turn, you can watch a couple of guys not throw the ball at each other.
I think there's like very specific groups that are going to want to play this. I think it's also worth noting that the physical copy of this game costs $70 or more.
Oh. Well, yeah, currently, simply due to kind of lack of inventory.
Yeah. I think, like, we didn't really understand how that could be until I just was looking at the Board Game Geek forum thread, where Keith Mateka responds in when people are asking, when is this going to be available again? I get the impression that they're just trying to do very limited manufacturing runs so they don't end up with unsold inventory. I think Thunderworks Games is really, it's probably just like a one-man operation. So I doubt he could afford to have 2,000 copies of Roleplayer shipped from China and then stuck in his garage. Like, that would probably bankrupt him. So when you do really low print runs, then stuff is just going to be necessarily more expensive. And then I think these like custom cardboard character sheets, that's where the lion's share of the manufacturing cost goes. Still though, like, as the consumer, $70, that's kind of steep, right?
It is just, you know, 6 character sheets, a bag of dice, and a deck of cards. Like, it does not feel like enough game, even though I think that it was, you know, like, there are some genius development parts of this game, like I was talking about with the market, that, you know, like, you feel like the game is good, but it's definitely not a $70 game. With a $70 game, I want tiny little miniatures that I can throw at you guys.
See, I kind of feel like that's, you know, that everybody's spoiled now with miniatures, and
yes,
the thing Yeah. And the thing about this game is that, you know, there's custom art on like every single one of those market cards, and you know, he had to pay artists to draw every single one of those pieces, and I think the art in the game is like is really, really good. It's
It's phenomenal.
surprisingly good
It is.
for a Kickstarter game. And yeah, I mean, it's got some pretty basic components, but they're all like they all work really well, and the character sheets are, you know, it's chunky cardboard. They've got all of the grids in them so that the dice fit, you know, just perfectly. And I think that,
And putting the dice into cutouts is a really satisfying feel. If this was a
yeah.
flat sheet of cardboard where you were trying to put the dice just on top of a little block, it wouldn't feel nearly as good. The game itself is very well done, but again, I've been spoiled by other games, you know, and I see this price point as requiring more, which is a real shame. I wish this guy would sell out and, you know, Hasbro would take care of those logistics issues for him.
If only that were an option.
I'm sure it's not.
I spent $70 on it, and I think that says more about me and what I was willing to do to get a hold of this game, because you know the MSRP for the game is definitely not $70. He wasn't selling it for that much on his website when he had plenty of copies. So I think that's just the market reacting to the fact that there's a lot of demand for
I
it.
think I agree with both of you. Because for one, I agree with Jeff. Compared to other stuff out there, this shouldn't be $70. But compared to how much I enjoy other stuff that is $40, this ought to be $70 for me, right? The mechanics of this are so well designed and so geared toward the nuts and bolts, like systems interaction player that I am, and I like the components so much that if you hadn't bought this for $70, Michael, but we had sat down to play a copy at the local game store a couple of times, I would have bought it for $70. You know, I wish I owned my own copy of this game. I like it so much. I feel like, unfortunately, on the one hand, you're going to need to like play this game a couple times to decide whether it's worth 50 or 60 or 70 or whatever you have to pay. That's unfortunate. You're going to have to play it a couple times ahead of time to really know whether it's worth it to you. But fortunately, if you just go to tabletopia.com, you can play the entire thing for free, which we have done several times, even though we already own a copy of the game.
Yeah, and that was our first Tabletopia experience, and I mean it's a surprisingly satisfying version of the game, right? It's got in case you're not familiar with Tabletopia, it's kind of like a it's a almost a tabletop simulator, and it doesn't necessarily enforce the rules of the game. So if I want to, I can roll the dice more times than I'm allowed to. I could, you know, I can flip them around to a specific face. I can pick up all the cards and then fan them all out all over the table.
In other words, you can cheat with the components physically the same way you could if you were just
But
playing with them.
yeah, exactly. It's like you have all of the components that come in the actual box, but you're just exploring them inside of a browser, which I think is kind of amazing. Like you don't even have to install anything on your computer. It's cross-platform. It's got really, I mean, the multiplayer like is kind of easy to set up. Everybody can join the game and play, and I'm having a lot of fun with it, and I'm super excited about, you know, potentially playing other games on that platform.
There's even the factor with role players specifically. Tabletopia has all of the components, including two promo pieces that the regular box copy doesn't come with. There's a
Ooh.
Frogkin character race that I think it's a promo race. I think because the first game that Thunderworks Games put out was called Bullfrogs, about like battling frog warriors on a pond full of lily pads. That's all I know about it.
Like
But
you do.
then there's a market card called the Cursed Ring that is the only true gacha card that you can do in the game. It's not even in the base game. It's a promo card. You buy it, you give it to another player, and it's worth -1 point. And they can pay you a certain amount of money
To
to
give it
give it
back to
to
you?
you. Yeah. So it's like, you know, as far as options go, the Tabletopia version is like in box a superior product, quote unquote. But I don't. I don't think we can stress enough, reaching into the dice bag, like Scrabble style, and grabbing four or five randomly colored dice and then rolling them on the table and seeing what's there and then picking it up and putting into your little cardboard sheet. Just that physical process is really satisfying. So I personally recommend buying a physical copy of this game for your group.
But play it on Tabletopia first to see if you like it.
Do that.
You can.
And if you do play it, and it does strike a chord with you, you'll see just how much effort obviously was put into it. This is a really well balanced game. And it really feels like there was an awful lot of thought put into so many different parts of it.
I want to see Keith's spreadsheets.
Yeah.
Does that make me a huge nerd?
No, like, he's obviously a very talented designer. It's really clear by the end of your first game, when it all sort of starts falling into place in your head, how everything is interacting, how it all fits together. It's an impressive work.
Yeah. And we get to see what's next from him, I guess, in like just a few days, right? The
end of May. There's a Kickstarter for
May 23rd.
Yeah.
That's for the expansion to this?
For the expansion to Role Player, yeah.
Yeah, it's Role Player Monsters and Minions. And I guess they're, you know, the natural extension of a game about creating a character is, I guess, to see what those characters can potentially do once they're, you know, put into battle.
Go out, fight monsters, and kill a big bad, it seems like, is what phase two of the game is going to be with this expansion. I think it also expands the game to allow for up to five players.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Is there any tie-in with the Riot Games board game, Monsters and Minions?
Oh,
Mechs and Minions, I think. Is the game.
Mechs and Minions. Yeah, that, never mind. Sorry.
There's half of a tie-in.
Edit that out, intern Steve.
one of the other Geek Dads actually has a, I guess, a prototype of the expansion, and I asked him what it was like, and he said that you have another option besides throwing a card away in the market if there's nothing that you can buy. He said that it will actually give you points, which is interesting, and that it bumps up the number of players to five and adds about half an hour to the game. So
now this game takes with like a three-player game, it took us about an hour to play it. Is that right?
Hour and a half.
Depending on your familiarity with the game, with the mechanics, you know, it's going to get quicker, but also each player's like average time to decision made will make it take a little longer. And then how much you care about winning or losing will make it take a little longer. I'd say it averages about an hour for three players, but it can go a little longer if you're all really tryharding, which we were, both of those three-player games that we all shared.
When I'm done with this game, I am happy when I'm done with the round of this game, I'm happy to be done with the round of this game. I'm not looking to stretch a single episode of this game. I enjoyed the session where we played two rounds, but by the time that I'm that we're getting done with it, I'm really struggling to see exactly how adding an additional half hour onto a game and sort of destroying what I think is one of the delightful flavor caches of this, which is taking a part of a game that of a different game that is supposedly a chore, which is creating the characters for your role-playing game. You know, that's something that you have to do beforehand before you can actually play the game. That's what this game is. And then stretching it into, oh, well, now you're going to create the character and then you're going to do a thing with the character. Well, suddenly it's not just a focus on what's a side activity in a different game.
I think the game is a little like it's exhausting in a really good way. In that, like, you know, the trying to figure out precisely what to do in a certain situation and pulling those levers and kind of trying to anticipate how they're going to influence things down the road. It's mental gymnastics, and it leaves, at least me personally, you know, feeling kind of like mentally drained in a really good way. at the end of the game. So I definitely see what you're saying, but I definitely want to try out the expansion. Like I want to see what it does.
I have to withhold judgment. Like I agree with Jeff for sure that this game feels complete. You know, the theme is perfect. We're just going to make a character who did it the best. But this one is so good that I'm willing to withhold judgment and see, you know, maybe it's great with the expansion. Maybe it's even better with the expansion. Maybe in a sort of Lords of Waterdeep style, I feel like there's value to the base game and the game plus the expansion once all is said and done. But regardless, I think we're going to end up shelling out for it when it's possible, right? Like we all want to see.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So I've got a question for the two of you guys. Dave, do you show this game to your girlfriend who has never played any sort of role-playing game? Or Mike, do you introduce this game to your parents when you're at the beach?
No.
Is this a game that can be enjoyed by someone who's gotten no interest in role-playing games?
I want to say yes, but I think the truth is no. Like the mechanics are so strong that I would say yes. But our initial draw to the game, to the theme, is what got us through that first very confusing, you know, like wandering in the fog playthrough. So I just don't know. I think probably not.
I think there's an overlap of potential players. You know, people who have not necessarily played a tabletop role playing game, but have played like, I don't know, like Diablo or some sort of like computer role playing game.
Yeah.
You know, they could potentially grasp the concept, and I think it would still be rewarding. But no, I'm not about to like ask my sister to play this like.
That's actually the other thing I thought when you asked the question, though, Jeff, is like the type of person that I would feel would enjoy the mechanics of this game, like the Venetian diagram, there's a really strong possibility that the person who would enjoy these mechanics has already geeked out and played, you know, a Dungeons and Dragons character once in their life, or at least is familiar enough with the concept that it wouldn't be like learning a new language completely. But no, I think I agree. I would not just grab my Monopoly buddy and say, let's play role player. I just don't think that works.
Yeah, I think it could be satisfying for someone to play. If for instance it was completely like reskinned, you know,
I'm
it's
already
still
working on my homebrew mod of making this into a Shadowrun game.
Yes.
But
Cyberpunk role player.
yeah, but I think it adds so much more. It's like so much more fun when that's the other thing we didn't even really talk about is at the end of the game, when you sit back and you pull out your phone and you take a picture, you know, of your like cowardly, clumsy, you know, schizophrenic like elf who is a guard. I don't know. Like you have this. It's perfect for like social media, right? You've got
Yeah.
this perfect little soundbite with a picture that you can post that tells a little story about the character that you made. It's like everyone wants to tell you about their freaking D&D character. This gives you kind of an easy and bite-sized way of doing
And
that.
it is fun to end up with like your dragonkin sorcerer who happens to be wearing four pieces of chain armor and holding a longbow. Like, what? Okay. Like, why not?
Yeah. I mend it, but I didn't max
Exactly. So I had wanted us to talk about multiplayer solitaire games in general, and then this became the game that we were going to discuss for this episode. And I think we sort of just got to the end of my proposed discussion, which is it good or bad if a game is multiplayer solitaire? And I think the answer is like, who cares? Is it fun, right? You know, this game has, we all seem to agree, just the right amount of potential interactivity, and it goes on sort of a sliding scale based on how many players there are in the game. But then if there's less in a four-player game, that's probably good because you probably want to be talking with a group of four people more often than you want to be staring at everyone else's sheet, right? But if you sit down to play a head-to-head game, it's a lot more interactive, but that's probably because you are playing much more competitively. I invited Jeff over to play role player. It's probably because we both want to play to win role player. Where do you guys land on this, Jeff? You think so?
Oh, absolutely. I definitely think that you know, it's all about the mood that you're in. And if you're in the mood to play a game that is this, I don't know, particular and, you know, numbers driven, you're probably also not hugely in the mood to just play the dick over the next guy game. That's not what this is. And those sorts of games, you know, those are party games. So like that's sort of my general answer about multiplayer solitaire games. And I feel that this game is an excellent example of not trying to stick too many mechanics in that are designed around that. It works well for itself.
I mean, you only know if a game is too solitary to play with other people once you've played it a few times. And then it's completely it's completely subjective. So for this one, I feel like it's the perfect amount.
I don't know where I come down on Lords of Waterdeep anymore, having played this one. I used to think Lords of Waterdeep had a very appropriate amount of player interactivity, and it scaled pretty well from 2 to 5 or whatever players. But now I'm not so sure. I think this one might even do it better. But maybe that's just because maybe the specific flavor of the system's interactions is something that appeals to me even more than Lords of Waterdeep. Maybe that's coloring my perception of it.
Well, I mean, you just ask yourself the question, like, am I paying attention when the other person is making their move? Like, is that something... am I invested enough in the game to where I care what they're doing, even if it doesn't directly influence me? Because I think if you are paying attention, and like going back to Waterdeep, when we're playing these games on iOS, like, it's annoying that it cycles through everyone's moves before it gets to you. But if I miss someone's move, I almost always X out of the game and come back in so I can catch up on it. And like, that means that I care enough about what they're doing to pay attention, and that influences the way that I'm playing. So it's not solitaire.
So then another game like Puerto Rico, very multiplayer solitaire, even though you're each choosing a role that gives you like a benefit, would you ever choose a certain role in Puerto Rico to deny me the benefit of like the role chooser, right? Like if I chose mayor, I was going to get an extra colonist. Would you ever choose that instead of what benefits you the most just to deny me that one tiny little benefit? It's so rare in a game of Puerto Rico that's not like at the very last turn. You know, you would almost never go out of your way to do something that didn't benefit you more than it hurt someone else.
Yeah, I mean, that game is all about choosing the thing that is going to potentially prevent other people from doing the thing that benefits them the most, because it will benefit you the least. So it's like, you don't want the person to ship goods because you're going to lose all your shit.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's,
I don't necessarily know if I agree with that assessment of Puerto Rico, but I do think that in general these things are actually nice in that with fewer numbers of players, there's a lot more benefit in these sort of passive ways of interacting with other players. That seems to be something that's a little easier to do with only a couple players, because it pays off so much more for you to take something away from someone else in a two-player game or a three-player game than it is in a five-player game. In a five-player game, you're just scrambling for whatever points that you can get for yourself. It almost never pays to attempt to give a mandatory quest to another person in a five-player game, unless they are, you know, you're battling with them for first place and it's at the very end of the game.
Is it that I'm
That's the exact example I was going to give.
Is it that I'm already much better at role player than I am at Puerto Rico? Not like, is that the case? I know that's true. I understand role player much better than I understand Puerto Rico, even after all the years. Would I feel like it was more interactive if I was better at Puerto Rico? I almost never feel like it's a worthwhile choice to deny you something rather than take the most beneficial for me in Puerto Rico. Maybe I just don't get it.
An awful lot of Puerto Rico is, I certainly feel that an awful lot of Puerto Rico is understanding, you know, the three or four strategies that are sort of are possible, and seeing places where you can gain small advantages but totally screw over someone else. You know, if you make a whole bunch of stuff rot for someone else, you can pretty much take them out of the game Or take them out of the end game anyways and just focus on the other people. It's great to do that.
Yeah, but it's a completely different way of the sort of cyclical way that those rounds work is kind of it's like a different way of screwing people over than maybe something like role player.
Yeah.
The way that the first player token or whatever it is, the governor token kind of interacts with the way that the rounds go. I don't know. I haven't played enough Puerto Rico recently enough to say one way or the other.
Or as National Public Radio refers to it, Puerto Rico. How many proper nouns are there, by the way? I don't know, but it's got to be like less than 8 that NPR has just randomly decided in their style guide. We will pronounce these 8 proper nouns as if we were people who lived in the place that we're talking about, but every other proper noun we're just going to pronounce like Americans. Why did they decide that? It's like we have the Oxford comma, we spell Ms. with an MS, and we say Puerto Rico. Like, that's... it's the one sheet. I don't get it.
I don't think it's actually it. I think it's just one out of every 8 words on NPR is spoken by Silvia Poggioli.
Is that it? Okay. Oh, boy.
Well, pronunciation is very important.
This call may be monitored for quality and insurance purposes. I saw Natanya almost pop an eyeball out of her skull yesterday. She was so mad just reciting this recorded message from a Brazilian, like a Brazilian wing of a tech support company.
No, I think they were actually from Puerto Rico.
Oh, they really were. They really were from Puerto Rico? Okay, that's amazing. Well, we don't know what we're playing next time, right? We're not sure.
Puerto Rico, maybe?
Maybe. Well, whatever it is, it's probably going to be what we use to replace the copy of Castles of Mad King Ludwig that I spilled beer all over. So I owe the group a game that is new in box that Jeff will then own. We're not sure what it's going to be yet.
Yeah, any suggestions would definitely be welcome.
So
from our many listeners.
Any other thoughts? We do want you to get in touch with us if you have played role player or if you are thinking about playing role player. You can email us at show@dissection.com and we would love to hear from you guys. Remember, it's free at Tabletopia. We can't stress enough that you should go play this game. It's the full game. It's got all the components. It's just like you're playing with the real thing. It's just online. You don't even have to be in the same place. So fire up Skype, get a friend, try it out.
And definitely keep an eye on Kickstarter May 23rd for the expansion. Role player Monsters and Minions.
Remember, full disclosure, we paid for this game. We just love it. I mean, to varying degrees. Like I wish I was the one to buy this game. I'll say that again. If there's a combo on Kickstarter, I may shell out to own my own copy if it ends up being a at least remotely reasonable to buy the base game and the expansion.
But yeah, I think it maybe bears some explanation, but you know, we're working to try to actually play these games a lot more maybe than in the past. So the likelihood that we're going to spend as much time on a less than entertaining game is it's not going to happen. So we're only going to really dissect games that we enjoy.
You know, we can play Bad Detective again.
Ooh, boy.
Yeah.
Well,
I guess maybe we could have like a Bad Games episode or something and talk about all the ones that sucked and why they went wrong. But
it's
generally speaking,
it's so easy to dunk on a game we don't like that we could easily squeeze that into every single recording, right? What have we played since the last time we spoke to you that we didn't really care for? I mean, There was some merit to Bad Detectives, but it did not work for us at all, right?
All right, we'll have a whole night playing Monopoly and Talisman. Monopoly with free parking.
I would play 30 games of Monopoly to avoid playing one game of Talisman. You can hold me to that. If that somehow becomes the devil's bargain that I have to make, I'm in.
Our friend Brian always threatens to bring over the farming game, which is a really special game all about like taking on huge amounts of debt in order to continue with your family farm.
Is this like one of those like 1970s not so hidden moral games?
Yeah, yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. I think it was like designed at a college or something. But I think one of these days it would actually be pretty entertaining to play it and talk about it. He brought it by once, and we started playing it, and it was not fun. It's not a fun game.
But you're supposed to come away with knowledge or understanding of the plight of the American farmer.
Yeah, I guess it's like Chutes and Ladders, but for agriculture.
You know, I have never played Agricola. If someone owns that, I want to try it. Speaking of farming, I don't know. Anyway, we're just rambling now. Let's get out of here, guys. Thank you so much for coming back, Michael Harrison.
Yeah, pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
Yeah, always happy to be here.
Okay, end of the show. Find us at dissection.com. Email us, show@dissection.com. Twitter, @dissection. Facebook.com/dissection. Please share a friend to this show. Share a friend with us. No, share this show with a friend.
We need friends.
Leave a review at iTunes. Our theme song is Winter Error by Luke Hash. Check it out at jamendo.com. That is all. For Michael and Jeff, I'm Dave Kirby, and we will see you soon. Thanks, guys.
This podcast has been a production of the Geek Dad Podcast Network. If you've enjoyed this content, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geekdad.
I cast Fireball.